Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor of the State of California and your moderator for today's program. And now I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, Senator Chris Dodd. As a former United States Senator, Chris Dodd is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the Motion Picture Association of America, which serves as the voice and advocate for the U.S. motion picture, home video, and television industries around the globe. Appointed not too long ago, in March 2011, Senator Dodd leads the association's efforts to represent the interests of one of the most creative, undoubtedly one of the most creative and productive industries in America. Today we'll be addressing the issues surrounding how to protect creative content, such as film and music, in a world that is becoming progressively networked, a hyper-connected world, while also preserving freedom of information on the internet. Welcome, Senator Dodd.
Gavin, thank you very, very much, and nice to be with you.
Yeah.
And thank you for the introduction, and it's great to be back in the Commonwealth Club. I was here many years ago with, I think, a head of black hair in those days, as a new member of the United States Senate going back. And I was recently asked whether or not I missed Congress, and I said, yes, but not this one. I can say that respectfully. So I assumed this new role of, as the head of the Motion Picture Association, and exciting. Someone once said, if you can do something different, do something very different. And this is certainly different in many ways. It's good to be back, not just here in the club, but I was telling Gavin as we were coming in, because a conversation, obviously a lot of conversation about technology and content and how we manage to bring these two incredible worlds together in a way that's going to serve the same individual, the user as well as the audience of the best content produced anywhere in the world, here in this state, as well as in other states around the nation. And it's it's exciting to be involved and come back to an area where I was deeply involved with the technology community. I wrote the Private Securities Litigation Reform Bill back some years ago, where startup or law firms, lawyers were generating computer-driven lawsuits against startup companies and holding them hostage for years in some cases. And we worked very carefully and managed to get a bill passed. I was telling Gavin the humor of it, if there's any humor in any of this, was that it was during President Clinton's administration. And it came down and we passed the bill, but the president was sort of torn between the legitimacy of our issue and the trial bar. And anyway, he vetoed the bill. And 48 hours later, I overrode his veto, the only one that was overridden in his 8 years as president. Which made it awkward was I was also simultaneously the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, responsible for getting him reelected. It was a very difficult time, in a sense, to get through all it. So the TechNet community, and I had a good, strong relationship during those years in Congress, and for many reasons to be delighted to come back again and to be in the community in the presence of people who are involved in the industry. I don't have any long-winded speech. I've given up filibusters and long-winded speeches, having left the Senate. But let me just say, starting out, a couple of things. One is, this evening is a wonderful opportunity to have a conversation about this important issue. How do we make sure that the Internet works for everyone, in a sense? How do we make sure, in a way, that the innovation and creativity, which has been the hallmark of our country, when you think of it, the nation that provided a place where a Microsoft and a Google and an Apple were born, NASA and the tremendous advances they created, as well as the incredible content that we've produced as a nation, going back almost 100 years, leading the world. Someone said to me the other day that even people who don't like us as a country and sometimes engage in acts that we would find offensive, when they get finished that day and go back home at night and given a choice on entertainment to watch, will choose the American product in more cases than not. And so we're a nation that has both been a great home to innovation, to creativity, to incredible advances in technology, not just recently, but going back years, and also simultaneously. In fact, this state, I've often said that someday someone's going to write, if we don't work this out in a way that serves everyone's interests, the question will be asked, how was it in this one country, in the state where arguably the global capital of content, entertainment content, was in one city, and a car ride away was arguably the global capital of technology. And how was it these people in the same country, in the same state, a car ride from each other, couldn't figure out how they needed each other? The technology without content, content without technology, obviously is almost absurd. Or that we're asking people to choose one side or the other, as if somehow there was a victory in all of that. Instead of figuring out how do we take the incredible talent and ability that exists to bring them together in a way that allows us to continue to lead in the technology sector as well as providing that incredible content that the world over enjoys so much. So I see that as part of the responsibility. It's a remarkable industry. I know many of you know about it a lot. This morning, 2.1 million people in this country got up and went to work on a job dependent upon the film and television industry. The average wages are about $56,000 a year. That includes selling popcorn as well as some overpaid actor. We have very good pensions and health care. It's a highly organized business. We bring back more revenue to the United States than agriculture, automobiles, or aerospace. We have a positive balance of trade with almost every country in the world in which we have a presence here. And again, as I mentioned earlier, a beloved product. It's not only sort of entertainment. I suspect every one of us in this room can cite an experience we had that motivated us, educated us, because of a film. We'd like to all think it happened because we read our history books or some speech someplace convinced us otherwise, but it may have been something like To Kill a Mockingbird or some other production that really did cause change in many ways beyond just the raw entertainment associated with the product. So my goal in this job, now that I'm sort of 16 months into it, having not come from the technology community or come from the entertainment community, and having wrestled with 99 other senators for 30 years, not to mention the House of Representatives, various administrations, I'm trying to get things done at a time where we're getting harder and harder to get things done. How do I take that experience, if it will, and see if I can't become an agent to bring some elements together to sort this out in a way that allows us to go forward and celebrate, as you should, the greatest advances in technology as well as providing that home for content in which we can protect it in a way. I think all of us agree, I don't know if anyone doesn't, that this it's fundamentally wrong to steal the genius of someone's creations here. And so how do we manage to protect that and simultaneously provide all of the new opportunities, the platforms and technology providing, so audiences can watch what they want to watch, when they want to watch it, how they want to watch it, where they want to watch it, as they're going to demanding already, globally. It's exciting to be a part of that and to see that exploding in front of us. And so that's really the challenge in a way, and we'll talk this evening about some of the ideas on how to proceed and do that. So I'm excited about this. I've been anxious to come up here ever since I took this job because I was sort of tired of this, what side of the street are you on? Pick a team in a way. And it's kind of really almost ridiculous on its face when you think of it that we've divided up this decision or this discussion in a way that really doesn't get us moving along in the direction I think we ought to be taking as a people. So with that, Gavin, I thank you, and I thank the Commonwealth Club for asking me to be up here tonight. I've asked Mitch Singer, by the way, because the title of our conversation this evening is Creative Content in the Cloud. And this wonderful individual who works with Sony has spent the last 10 years of his life coming up with new technology and an idea on how people can store and keep their content in a way they own to be able to watch it and access it anywhere, anytime, under any device they have. And we're going to talk, hopefully, a little bit about ultraviolet, which is what Mitch has been working on. I thought it might be interesting to have someone in the audience who actually has been doing this for a decade in his life on creating exactly the kind of technology advances that are being developed here. 75 technology and content companies have worked for almost a decade on this idea, a wonderful example of actually coming together. The Jeff Skolls of the world, eBay, also Academy Award winning, obviously, and this Friday will be the 1 year anniversary of the loss of Steve Jobs. Hard to believe it was just a year ago when it happened. But again, what a remarkable individual. You've got a Bob Iger at Disney who's on the board of Apple, Sheryl Sandberg who's with Facebook and on the board of Disney. So you've got a lot of people already kind of working this thing a bit, and I don't think it's as widely well known, and we need more participants in that kind of a conversation. So again, I guess I did filibuster, didn't I?
Oh, it was great. I don't have any questions.
Stop
there. But Senator, I want to jump in, and
sure.
There's so many directions to go with that outstanding overview. But I'm curious your motivation. I mean, 36 years in Congress, 6 years in the House, and of course Senate, 30 years. I didn't see this coming. I imagine all kinds of avenues, all kinds of experiences you'd be having, but I didn't see the Motion Picture Association. What was
well,
that?
I didn't either, I can tell you. But yeah. If you had told me 2 years ago we'd be sitting here having this conversation, I might have wondered what each of us was smoking.
Were you a big movie buff? Were you passionate about the industry? Were you an advocate?
No, sort of an average. The industry came and asked me to get involved. And candidly, my first reaction was I like a normal person. I go to a certain number of movies. I'm not encyclopedic on it, as some are, as I've learned. But what I sort of got into this thing, and it's such a transformative time we're in. It's such an exciting time. I tell people that work in our offices, you're going to be able to tell your grandchildren about this time that you were in, where all of this explosion occurring, incredible opportunity. When you think of, I have two very young children. I'm a late bloomer in the father business. I have a 7-year-old and 11-year-old daughters.
Yeah.
I used to say I was the only person I knew that got mail from AARP and diaper services. I had this kind of a, I had this kind of a broad reach here. And so obviously I'm very interested in content as a parent, and I'd like to lock my daughters up on an island until they're 40. Other than that, I'm fine with watching whatever they want to see along the way. And so the more I looked into it, I realized this is incredibly exciting, this question that's before us, and an exciting industry. I had no idea about the number of people who worked in this business. I had no idea in my own state. There are 15,000 people in Connecticut that get up in the morning directly employed by the television and film industry. Blue Sky Studios that made Ice Age and Rio, if you saw any of those animated products, I had no idea they existed in Connecticut. There's not been a great deal of communication, and I say this respectfully, of the industry, of marketing their business. They market their products. And I don't think I was different than an awful lot of people. And as a candidate for public office, Gavin, you won't be shocked to know that I occasionally came out here to raise money for my campaigns and would raise money in the Hollywood community. I can't recall any time anyone pulling me aside for a couple of minutes and saying, let me talk to you about the business I'm in. You go to Detroit, you come up here over the years, and people want to know, where are you on some of these questions? Legitimate, by the way. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But I always found it interesting that there was never that conversation with the content industry, in a sense. And it may be because it was sort of a given that only a few years ago there were three networks, no internet, no cable, anything else. And so you went to a movie theater or you watched three networks for television. And that wasn't that long ago. That's not ancient history. So they may have felt that they didn't need to do that. And the more I sort of learned about this and realized how many jobs in the country, with a high school diploma and a couple of years of technical training, you can get a very good job in the content industry in television and film. I'd be hard-pressed to think of another industry where that's true today. I'm not discouraging people from getting a higher education, but how many of us have heard there just aren't jobs out there for people with that high school diploma and some technical training? This industry provides that. As a technician, a sound person, a film person, others, you can do it. And it isn't just here in the state. The jobs, 25,000 people get up everyone directly employed in Georgia, Louisiana, New Mexico. We've now, through incentives, have stopped the runaway shops. Only a few years ago, the second largest production site was Vancouver, Canada. We're now doing a lot more here in the United States, and it provides real jobs for people in these communities. So that got me excited about this, and then this explosion that occurred, as many of you may know, maybe don't know, but members of the Senate are prohibited from talking to their former colleagues for 2 years after you leave office. Mm-hmm. So having left on January 3rd of 2011, I'm prohibited from talking to my colleagues. Here, Dianne Feinstein and Nancy are great friends of mine. I can't even really talk to them.
About issues.
Anything. Yes, issues.
Well, it's awfully difficult. How do you go? Conversation
well, you know, but that gets
kids.
Pretty hard. I mean, you've got to sit down. What am I going to talk to? I mean, after 2 minutes about how are your kids? You know, we spent 30 years together in the Senate and the Congress. And I've known Nancy Pelosi and my sister were roommates in college. So I've known Nancy since she was 18. And I served with Phil Burton and Sala, and John Burton and I were elected to the House together the same year, so there's a community out here I know well. Some people said, how do you like this 2-year ban? I said, there are moments when I wish it were 10, in a sense, right? I can't change the law on this thing. So when the SOPA, PIPA whole thing blew up, in a sense, it was a transformative event where 8 million emails, I think, in 7 days came in and just blew the doors off, and I think have changed forever. How people are going to address their elected representatives on a state level or national level on any sort of issue.
Well, let's jump in. I mean, I think most people are familiar what these, SOPA, PIPA, but why don't we just say SOPA, Stop Online Privacy Act. PIPA was what, the Senate version of the same?
Actually, a better drafted bill. The House bill was not well.
So its intent was what? I mean, let's sort of step back and explain this debate and this conflict, as you say, between content providers and the technology community, which we could broadly here in California define as sort of a north-south divide. That's a loose definition, perhaps unfair. But what was the purpose of
the purpose of it was, that involved was basically we had written laws to deal with in a domestic setting where there was illegal content. And so there are avenues through the Justice Department, the courts, and due process and so forth. The problem was, and no great, you don't need to have a PhD in criminology to know this, that obviously elements realized that was a problem, so you move offshore. And so then it becomes an offshore issue, and then how do you deal with that? So the effort with that was to go after the offshore sites in a way. And again, let me just, because we can move on, I think that's important. These bills are dead. They're not coming back, in my view, and it shouldn't. I think we need a whole new approach on this, that when we start getting people together, this idea we're going to have a brawl again on this subject matter goes right against everything I said at the opening comments to you.
Sure.
What's the point of this? What if one side does win or the other? Is that really a victory for anybody, in a sense, when you think about it? I don't think it is. So we need to do what we're doing. Today, for instance, every one of the studios that I represent has a distribution agreement with Google, every one of them. They deal with each other every single day on matters.
And why that matters, again, just and we'll move, I'm not in, and I'm with you. I mean, let's focus on what to do, not necessarily finger pointing who's to blame. Mm. But it is important, for folks that may not understand this as intimately as others. Google was one of those that were very concerned about SOPA. Sites like Wikipedia went black in protest. There was a day where I think 7,000 sites decided to shut down and protest. Google didn't shut down, but they basically blacked out their name and then directed people to a petition to oppose the bill. Folks like Reddit or organizations and Mozilla and others really organized. And that goes to your point, your comment, that things changed. Because I think we're quoted as saying, I've never seen in my 30 years anything like this. No. The momentum shifting away from something that was building support, where people were dropping their name as co-sponsors within minutes, not just hours. And it changes from your perspective the way governance works because of this ability for people to network and to collaborate and to petition in real time. Is that a
absolutely
fair
true.
Analysis?
Absolutely true. And you're, as a lieutenant governor of the state, I mean, not that many years ago, I used to... You know, I oftentimes get postcards that would be sent to me, and it would pre-printed postcards. It would be, "Dear Senator," and by the name blank, and then they'd say, "We want you to support or oppose a certain bill signed Harry Smith." On slow evenings, I used to take those cards, and I'd go through, and I'd call Harry and say, "Harry, I got your postcard here, and tell me again why you think Senate Bill 10 is a bad idea." And then, because these long silences, they just kind of sent down the card. No, I think so. But the petitions that used to really impress me as a member would be those 100 letters you'd get, where you could honestly, if you held the letter up to the light, you could see where people had actually drawn lines to make sure it was clear, probably wrote the letter two or three times so the penmanship was clear. It was a real act of faith, in my view, that people would spend that much time expressing their view on a subject matter. And that was a big deal to me over the years to get that kind. Then the world changes, obviously, and there's a whole new way for people to access and to be able to communicate ideas, which is exciting to me in a way, where it's much easier now for people to communicate. And so this was the first event that I've ever seen where something like this, and it was an issue, obviously, that people had, there was an appeal to people on breaking the Internet or First Amendment rights, which I would take issue with, but nonetheless, that was the argument, and so went forward. Because, I think it's important looking forward. And I should have said this at the outset, because we're in the land up here where technology is so important. To Google's great credit, recently changed their algorithm to a point where they're now going to, where there are enough complaints and so forth about a site, move that site down on their page, which I applaud, and we do. That's exactly the kind of efforts we need collectively. Right. It didn't require a law to do it. There wasn't a regulation that got passed. It's just people coming together, figuring out how can we make this work in a way. Now, they also agreed, I hope they do this as well, is simultaneously take that legal site and give it a higher profile so that when you actually go, on the assumption that most people, I think, given the choice, would like to know that they're dealing with a legal site. If the one's illegal, one's legal, they'd prefer to deal with the legal site. And so getting that kind of cooperation is important. I mentioned earlier the conversations that are ongoing daily between the technology community and the content community, figuring out how can we come up with some ideas that will work so we're all achieving the same results, getting that internet to work for everyone, the shared concern, the shared goals, and protecting the technology, that it's not going to be broken or destroyed in any way. And as an industry that would have died decades ago had it not been for freedom of expression. You think of it, you think of the films that have been made, how cutting edge they were, how pressing they were. A Gentleman's Agreement going back years ago, dealing with anti-Semitism, for instance. The courage of that industry to take on some of these questions. The sitcoms on television today that deal with sexual orientation that have changed that view in many communities, other than all the lecturing you could have and all the demonstrations, bringing into people's living rooms an example of what can happen. It's a critically important motivator and educator, in a sense, in my view. So this is getting that kind of cooperation where you can protect that content. And it's not inexpensive to do this. There's a Taylor Hackford, who many of you may know, is a Oscar-winning director for years. He said something the other day, which is kind of interesting. I mean, this is if you're talking about the low, really low cost film, Gavin, the $1 million to $5 or $6 million, sort of the handheld stuff, which can be very, very good. It does very well. Gets made. The big sort of tentpole, what they call the tentpole stuff, the Avatars, the Avengers, the Spider-Man stuff. The studios pay for that stuff, and it's expensive, and it costs a lot. What gets between that $10 million, though, and that's the range where I suspect an awful lot of people, when you talk about education, motivation, gets made. That's financed through a lot of private equity or investment capital. It's hard to get the dollars today to get people who invest in that. Not because they think it's not going to be a great movie or do well, but the fear that it's going to be such a losing proposition. Hurt Locker, which wins the Academy Award, is a classic example. It beats Avatars, the Academy Award. Remarkable film. Was not an expensive film when it was made at all. It was a financial disaster because by the time it got to the DVD market, it had been stolen so many times that it was just a loss. And so you start looking at that stuff that I suspect an awful lot of you here loved. If I asked you what were your favorite films, and I say this respectfully of the large tentpole stuff, but I suspect an awful lot of people it was that film, sort of the To Kill a Mockingbird kind, The Descendants, The Help, recently films that you might have found attractive. Those weren't hugely expensive, but you're going to have a hard time getting capital to come in to make that stuff if, in fact, there isn't some sense that the content of the creators, the innovators, the wonderful imagination, not only writing this stuff, but also then utilizing now the incredible technology. In fact, these studios are technology companies. This idea of it's old media versus new media or old technology, they are major technology companies, and I don't think that's as well communicated as it should be.
Right. So and then we'll move on. Mm. So SOPA PIPA, dead. You're saying you're not interested in a legislative solution. There's the open act. There's an effort by some leaders to move this forward. But from your perspective, it's the old framework, the tyranny of Orr versus the genius of Ann, that we can find a way to address the issue and bring folks together.
Absolutely.
Are there organized efforts now? Are they formal or informal? You mentioned Sheryl Sandberg, who sits on the board of Disney and also obviously a COO of Facebook that may have, as entities, been on different sides of this as potential conduits and bridges. Are you engaging with all your senatorial skills and the work you did on family and medical leave and the Health Care Act and all the work you did in Congress, starting to sit down and work through these issues? Where are we in terms of?
Well, there are people working on it and looking for ways. Again, ideally, you'd almost get to a business model of this in some way. So when you end up with things, talk about like the cloud, again, the ultraviolet idea, where actually people then, regardless of the device you have, can actually store and keep, share with people as well, where you can go and take all of the DVDs or the other hard goods you have, actually Walmart, and you correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mitch, you can actually go now, and Walmarts will take that and put it together for you into the cloud, so you don't have to go out every time you want to buy something, have to buy a new product and do it. It's exciting. It's just one example, but it's an exciting example of what can happen to really provide that consumer with the opportunity, regardless of the device you have now. Instead of having to buy a different device that literally, whether it's your iPhone or your iPad, whether it's your PC, whatever else it may be, wherever you are in the world. You don't have to lug around the hard goods any longer. You can access that, and you can share it with 6, 8, or 10 other people along the way. It's those kind of breakthroughs that I think offer tremendous opportunities. And the platforms are different. I mean, look, the days when people still love that theatrical experience, and they make a product for that big screen. But they're also now, you're going to have people making, the exciting thing is, with these new platforms that are emerging, and a generation that will want to see something on their iPhone, or want to see something on their iPad, may want to see it on their wristwatch in time. You're going to have people producing content for platforms, different platforms. So you don't, just have to say, no, unless you make it for the big screen, we're not interested. No, I think people are going to now really take advantage and explode, and markets are opening up all over the world. We had a new arrangement with China recently on the number of foreign films that can come in and their price point. India produces 1,200 films a year. No obstacles to us accessing that market. Different tastes about what they like at the film, but nonetheless excited. So there's a tremendous world out there that I think is anxious for product. So this ought to be a time of great growth in terms of the content industry and technology. And I think that's where we need to get people thinking about. How do we do this together in a way that makes sense for everyone involved?
So people are sitting down.
They are doing that.
Being made.
Jim Giannopoulos came up and spent the day with engineers at Google, for instance.
Head of Fox.
Jim Giannopoulos, an interesting guy, been in the business for years and years, came up and he was telling me about the day he spent with the engineer. It was a very productive day for him. Just one example. And that goes on all the time.
Because we already center have problems with the Dodgers up here in the north, and they have problems with the Giants. We can't have any more of this north-south.
Well, how would you like to be a Red Sox fan?
Thank God I'm not. But I'm not running for senator of Massachusetts. Want those questions. But key, I mean, obviously, this is incredibly important issue to a lot of people and drove a lot of passions. You were in the middle of all this more than anyone, so I don't want to belabor this, but I'm encouraged, and I think all of us are, that there's this kind of progress hopefully being made, and that there is a compromise that could be consensus as opposed to competing bills that just get pushed around in the Senate, in the House. Let's talk about, I think it is an important point you were making about the growth of the motion picture industry, film industry generally. You talk about China. I mean, it's interesting. A year ago, I read that China only, produced 20 foreign films or allowed 20 foreign films in their domestic market. Mm-hmm. And we only had, a dozen or so of those films.
Right.
You mentioned a new deal. Does that expand the opportunity and scope for American films to be shown in China?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's been around, I think the numbers, someone will correct me, Mitch, you correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's been like 25 years or so with that, in all foreign films. So you're right. It wasn't just us, the United States. Although we had probably 12 or 14 of the 20, generally, it would be the case. And through but it was a violation of the World Trade Organization, not the quotas. There were other problems. Actually, the World Trade Organization allows for quotas, ironically. But nonetheless, that was not the violation, but that produced the violations produced the negotiations, which produced the outcome. So now it's gone up by 14. So it's 34 foreign films that can come in on a yearly basis.
Still modest.
It is modest. And the box office percentage goes from, I think it was 13 or 14% to 25% now, which is still half of what it is everywhere else in the world, generally speaking. But here's what's exciting. China is building every single day 8 to 10 new screens a day. A day. Yeah. They did 75 IMAX theaters last year, 75 the year before. Now, you're starting from a very low number. I think there were only about a couple of thousand of screens in China only a few years ago. And they're a sophisticated audience. Deception, for those who saw the movie Deception, was more successful in China than any place in the world, including the United States. And not an easy film to understand in some ways, but to give you an idea of the sophistication of that audience. Here's the problem. And we also, there's no limitations on co-production, which will tell you something. The Chinese are very interested in becoming involved in the production of film and television, and want to market globally. The other day, the Wanda Company, which is a very successful Chinese company, bought AMC, one of the largest movie theater chains in the United States, if not the largest, maybe the largest. He is now, based on what he has in China and here, is the largest theater owner in the world, and looking for product all the time. So the co-production, there are no limitations. They do limit, and this won't shock any of you here, but you can show all the Avatars and Avengers and Spider-Man stuff you almost want. you're going to have a hard time showing To Kill a Mockingbird or The Descendants or The Help and so forth. They're not crazy about watching individuality at all. And that's then you're into a political area, which is rather difficult, to put it mildly. So as long as there's a certain genre that is acceptable, and you start showing lifestyle, other things, right, it gets dicey, to put it mildly. So that's great news, though. It's a breakthrough. Now, they've done some other things since then that are troublesome. A thing, they have blackout periods because by law in China, 50% of the moviegoers have to go to Chinese movies. recently, because of the success of some earlier films, 85% of the moviegoers were going to foreign or U.S. films. So they now have blackout periods, which shut down entirely thing. And what they call, I never hear of learning these new expressions, and double dating was something that most of us thought about as something else. Double dating in the film industry means that you have two movies released on the same day, the same time. So they took the Batman movie and the Spider-Man movie and released them both. And Spider-Man was a Sony picture on August 27th, and Prometheus, a Fox movie, I think 4 days later. And obviously that depresses when you've got forcing an audience to pick and choose, then the markets decline. So we're navigating all the time with these kind of issues that come up on how to open up. But that the markets are opening up, and this is where the opportunities
are. And it's not just, the growth rate of the film, meaning the revenue generated overseas for the industry is what, above 50%?
Oh no, it's almost 60% now, and maybe a little higher even.
And is that a trend line that's growing exponentially, or has it just been a long trend line where we're seeing increased revenue overseas?
I don't know the answer to that. Mitch, what is that? Is that recent, or is that?
It's been happening over the last few years.
Yeah.
Last few years.
And again, it's in Russia, for instance, they're building theaters over not quite the speed of China, but again, growing tremendously. Hmm. Indonesia, Indonesia is six times the size of the United Kingdom. and so markets in the Asian markets are offering tremendous opportunities again. And of course, the technology is making it possible. I mean, what is it? Something like 90% of the Indian population have iPhones.
Less than half toilets. It's an extraordinary fact. Yeah.
So all of a sudden, the online experience is going to provide all new opportunities. So as we expand the technological opportunities for people, it allows us to reach audiences that were unimaginable even a few years ago. Yeah. But obviously, if all you have is the technology and you don't have the content, one of the statistics I love, which, again, I think this audience will appreciate it. This sounds so counterintuitive, but it makes all the sense in the world to think about it. The average citizen in this country goes to the movies. I think the number is like 4.6 times a year, something like that. It used to be about 6 point something or other on average. A person with 5 or more, quote, technical devices, iPads, iPods, iPhones, goes to the movies on average 14 times a year. Now, when you think about it, it makes all the sense in the world. People who love technology love content. What would be the point of having it if you couldn't access content? And so there are, in fact, the best movie goers, if you will, are the people who embrace technology the most, in a sense, which makes all the sense in the world when you think about it. And so keeping that in mind as we talk about this, providing that technology to a growing set of populations around the world is going to be terrific for everybody. Obviously, the audience that wants the technology, and then to be able to feed that kind of content they want to see as well is critical.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. My guest today is former senator and now chair of the Motion Picture Association, Chris Dodd. I'm Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor, and I'll take a few audience questions. And a lot of them we picked up on the SOPA discussions and the PIPA discussions. But here's an interesting question, and they're related, around the recent video that was posted on YouTube, hardly a motion picture, quite the contrary.
Let me just be very clear. We had nothing to do with it.
Well stated.
let me say that again. We had nothing to do with that.
The question is, it's not mine, but it's an interesting one. What is the Motion Picture Association doing to address regional sensibilities? Because obviously that concern was about cultural competency issues, of theological issues, all these issues. Is there a considerate effort when you're looking at this global expansion to be considerate of the world we're living in and all the diversity?
Well, there is, but let me, again, and You know, we have a rating system which dates back to the 1960s that Jack Valenti put in place, that PG and PG-13 and R and HC-17 hasn't been looked at in, or at least changed at all in 25 years. Why was that necessary? You end up, it's only a few years ago that Houston, Texas, for instance, had its rating board. Other states have had them as well. You can imagine the nightmare of trying to produce something where you had to tailor edit your film based on which jurisdiction you were going to show it in. And there's a growing appetite to some degree. The state of Arizona decided they'd have their own immigration laws in the country. And so you're beginning to see, if you're not careful, whether this happens.
Yeah.
So the rating stuff, by and large, works. It's highly popular. We just did a survey among people in the country about, generally speaking, how do you feel about it. Over 80% of families, parents, still rely on the rating system. And so it's revered. Having said that to you, you know, the reason that this industry has done well is because freedom of expression has been awfully important. Even with the rating system, we don't even in R, parents want to take their kids to an R, that's their business. We don't tell them they can't. HC-17 is another matter, but nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get uneasy about the idea of all of a sudden becoming a cop on speech. And so, you know, obviously I understand these issues, and it was obviously a dreadful, that film. It was offended, I think, anybody that was familiar at all with it. It obviously had something to do, I mean, how much, I don't know, but something to do, obviously, with what exploded around the world and venue after venue. But I think we've also got to be careful at a situation, also when we start responding to that by deciding what gets made, what doesn't get made. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, bad examples can make bad law, in a way. So, and I think I'm speaking pretty much for this industry about this. We've been a great industry because, despite there have been others who wanted to put restrictions, and they still do in certain areas, we've been able to allow a lot of free expression that's had a lot to do with contributing to who we are as a country today, in my view, because people actually saw Roots, saw To Kill a Mockingbird, saw A Diary of Anne Frank. I mean, there are many stories. We'd all love to think it happened because they watched a documentary or read a history book. I think most people are probably motivated on a lot of these issues because of a story, mm-hmm. well told, that happened to reach in ways that nothing else could. And so I get very uneasy about sitting there and having us become, or someone become, a traffic cop on saying you can't make that dreadful product. Now, I you know, Google responded, YouTube obviously is part of Google responded by saying, look, we'll shut down the product if there's a country that it's illegal to do this in. And it was an intriguing kind of reaction, I thought, to it. And it's not illegal here, so obviously they turned down the president's request to stop streaming that product.
Yep.
You know, again, I'm just wondering myself, what happens here in a sense? Are we inviting other countries now to all of a sudden declare things illegal? Because, no one wants to go through what Denmark went through a few years ago when I was the cartoonist or so, yeah. made cartoons on Mohammed, and all of a sudden they were being subjected to either attacks or threats of attacks. So is all of a sudden someone, look, if that's how you play the game, I don't want to subject my people to something, I tell you, we'll declare something illegal. And that way we'll be able to deal with all this. Makes me uneasy. On that approach. And so we got to be careful how we react to these things in a way. So I don't know, that's some thoughts on it.
A couple questions here. I'll try to connect them and sum it up. But we talked about what's happening overseas and the revenue trends for the industry moving increasingly offshore.
Mm-hmm.
Issues of tax credits. I mean, you made the point that mm-hmm. this is a 50-state industry in the United States. This
yep.
is not New York and California any longer. But it's increasingly global in terms of that competition. And you have films, aggressive efforts in New Zealand, as an example, some of the biggest blockbuster films being filmed there. Obviously, the Harry Potter series over in England and elsewhere. What about America's competitiveness in terms of this industry? And what are you seeing as those trends, even between states, being aggressive as it relates to tax credits and recruiting and retaining, not just productions, but post-productions and pre-production?
Well, I think it's terrific. Again, it's at a time of economic difficulty. I was down where Steven Spielberg was making Lincoln in Richmond, Virginia. And just to give you an idea, aside from they were there for a number of weeks, used the legislature in Richmond as the site of the debate over the 13th Amendment, Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. It's not the whole book. They took the 13th Amendment argument, and Daniel Day-Lewis plays Lincoln, and it's gotten great reviews, those who've seen it. But the point I want to make is just what was being spent over those number of weeks, not the production staff, that was a lot of people doing this, a lot of extras and so forth, but just hotels, dry cleaners, restaurants, car rental operations, was generating about $200,000 a day in economic activity in Richmond. Yeah. And I can tell you that governor today is begging for any movie he can get or TV show to be made. It's why this is no longer a liberal conservative idea. The governor, Governor Granholm of Michigan, took one of the old automobile plants up there and built a sound stage in Michigan. And was doing a great job. There were a number of TV shows that were being made in that site, putting people back to work that had lost their jobs in the automobile industry. The new governor came in and said, you know, that's Hollywood stuff. We're not gonna do that any longer. So the crews packed up, and John Kasich, who's a very conservative new governor of Ohio, said, come on down, Ohio. And before those trucks crossed the border, Michigan, the governor of Michigan said, wait a minute, I didn't really mean that. Come on back. And so you're getting, there's an awful lot of the runaway shops now that literally poured out of the country, and they still do in some cases, are finding a very receptive community here in our country, putting a lot of people to work at a time when jobs are hard to find, generating economic activity, which is forced. You don't get the credits unless you actually do the job.
Right.
And this state lost, the numbers I saw recently, lost 90,000 jobs in the state that fled California. Yeah. To go to New Mexico and North Carolina and Georgia and Connecticut and elsewhere.
Louisiana. It's been really
Louisiana great. Pouring out. In New York City, it makes their 45 TV shows being made in New York City. Unprecedented. But again, they've gone out of their way to attract that business.
And we're losing in California because we have a tax credit, but it's not competitive.
It hasn't been competitive, and it's been a short term. Let me just quickly say to thank the legislature and thank the governor who signed it in law the other day. And I think that's going to change this in a way. And it's because obviously people who will hear and work in this business, given the choice and druthers, I think would prefer to be working in an area where they live and can be home at night with their families and the like who are involved in it. So there's enough just incentives alone to be here in the state. And, of course, it's incredible, obviously, the geography of the state, the diversity that the state offers, add all of that to the potential of being here. So I think it's going to help tremendously in reversing.
But do you think the challenge in the past with the tax credits, and when I was mayor, we actually did our own local tax credit because we were frustrated by the lack of efforts and incentives at the state and provided access here on Treasure Island at some of those old hangars to a number of TV series and motion pictures, including, interestingly, Rent, which was a New York-based script that was filmed wonderfully here in San Francisco. That said, is it difficult from your perspective and looking from your previous career and legislative career to convince people that it's not all red carpets, that it's not all Oscar parties?
Yeah, I think it is.
This incentive is, I mean, as you say, it's about dry cleaners. It's about that guy or gal picking up the truck, the catering truck, and doing the deliveries of the lumber yard folks that get the benefit and the lighting.
One of the things I'd love to see the industry do is, not at the end, I mean, how many of us stay around to read the credits? I mean, you know, it's a... We're out the door. I mean,
there's one person in the audience. Three. Now everyone's raising their hand. I'm not sure I believe.
But most people, they pack out. I've often thought they ought to, at the beginning of a movie, just say whatever it is, that there were, 8,000 people involved in the production of the thing you're about to see.
Point.
And just the other people know, so you're not staying around to the end, but you have some idea of what's involved in this, a way of reminding people. I was on the set and outside of Boston in a new movie. You may have seen the advertising. Actually, it was a year ago called Boom. That is about a high school and a band and a guy's a wrestler and he goes. This is a Sony picture. I think it's a Sony picture. It's a Sony picture. And he goes off and decides that he can save the high school band if he goes into the wrestling. He was a college wrestler. But he goes into the worldwide wrestling operation, and he gets, of course, his brains beat out every night. But you get paid whether or not you win or lose, so this is the way he saves the band. Anyway, I'm on the set with these kids, and the local high school students in Quincy actually were in the movie. They used the old high school next to the new high school to film. And so I was standing there, and the producer said, "Would you like to say anything to the children?" I said to him, "Look, I just would like you to think about something. You know, you're going to see yourself on film or part of it. But I want you to know something. I want you to look around the room. And I want you to look behind that fellow behind that camera, that woman who put that makeup on you,
right.
That lighting guy over here, that truck driver you saw outside, that electrician who's plugging things in. They're not movie stars. They're paying mortgages. They're providing for the health care of their family if they can. They're trying to save for a college education. These are hard-working, creative Americans. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of them across this country who do incredible work, incredible work. And instead of respecting them, when you think about this and this movie gets made, remember those people. When next time you're thinking about, you know, what the hell, I think I'll just, you know, I'll go to that illegal site and just grab one of these things. Forget about whether or not you're stealing from the big actor who's being paid or the producer or the director. Tell me that you're not going to be offended if you realize I'm stealing from that makeup artist, that woman who may be raising a family on her own. Tell me that's okay. It's okay to do that, in a sense. Or to that guy behind the microphone or whatever. And you need to think about that. These are people who get up every day and create incredible products for us that we love and enjoy. You've got great, because we talk about Hollywood, but I'm going to spend tomorrow over at Lucasfilms. You don't have to. I can walk to that almost. This isn't a traveling downstate or going to some other state in the United States. One of the talk about a technology company. Yeah, it's film, but it's really a great technology company.
Right.
And so going out to the Presidio and seeing what they're doing out there. Pixar. I mentioned Steve Jobs. What a difference that made for Disney and animation. Again, so in addition, any more than suggesting up here is just technology and is just and
right.
Hollywood is
right.
Content. There are technology companies and your film companies up here. We got to break through this thing. If nothing else, I just pray. And again, I having long conversations in great detail about all of this, but just as sort of a layman coming in for a year and a half in this,
sure.
I just pray that people understand what we ought to be trying to do
yeah.
to get this thing working right.
Yeah,
now.
Well, I yeah. couldn't agree more with yeah. that. There are a lot of questions. It's interesting, a number of questions. Comparing of sorts, and there one declarative statement, not a question, but the movie industry to the music industry as it relates to the issues, as you point out, of the ubiquity of the cloud now and the access points, the mobility,
right.
social, local, and all the change. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, yes and no, and I think this much. Look, you're getting, I think there's a real effort here to developing that product, making it accessible to people, establishing a price point that is going to be affordable to people and still allow for the productions to occur. And there's a real effort here. And I think the lessons, obviously, some have learned out of the music industry. I think, and I say this again respectfully, but going on earlier, where we're going after that P2P situation where you're talking about the kids in many cases and all of a sudden trying to arrest someone doing that, I think was misguided, mm-hmm. got you off on the wrong track. And
yeah.
I know that happened in the music industry. I think there are other places where we can focus our attention and make a difference. So I think there were some lessons learned about how to approach it that might not have been learned as well had people not gone through the experience with Napster and the like coming along in the music industry. So that's been very worthwhile, I think, as well. And again, I mean, the things that Mitch Singer is doing and colleagues of his, I mentioned earlier, I think it's 75 companies. I think that was the number I'm familiar with, Mitch. Technology and content companies working on the ultraviolet. Did I explain the ultraviolet thing well? Do you want to take 2 seconds or 30 seconds, whatever?
I don't have a mic, so I don't know how your radio audience...
We'll translate
yeah.
what you say
yeah.
to the radio audience.
Anywhere you buy a motion picture, it appears in your own personal cloud, and you can access it on any device you choose.
Right. Simple as that. So as you're waiting for a taxi cab, you can watch it on your cell phone.
Whatever.
When you're in the cab, you can
yeah.
watch it.
And you saw where Fox recently came up with this idea, because you have that sort of that period between in the post-theatrical experience and before the so-called DVD experience. And they've now, Fox has made that decision to provide and the post-theatrical experience prior to the DVD coming out space. So there are people trying different ideas on how to create more access to product. I was with someone the other day, and they said, I watched Arbitrage the other night. And I said, where'd you see it? And they said, I saw it on my PC. I said, how'd you see that? The thing just came out. Well, no, you've got a lot of independent filmmakers that are, frankly, because there isn't a big audience, theaters are not rushing to see Arbitrage. There's an older audience that's probably going to see that film. And so
is that Richard Gere?
Yeah, it's Richard Gere.
He's a young guy.
Well, I agree, but you and I are getting older.
Apparently so.
And so that went right. There's some theaters running it, but they went right to an online opportunity as well. And so that's the kind of creativity that's occurring.
Right. A couple of, and these are not my questions, so I'm not accused of indicting the motion picture industry, but this idea that there's an ever-increasing trend in the movie industry for a film to make a big profit instead of having the art and the acting and the basically this idea of just blockbusterification of the industry. And you mentioned some notable exceptions, The Help, Descendants, and others, and Hurt Locker that sort of broken through. But do you sense there's that larger trend? And let me just extend. There's also a question of originality, that it's this movie, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you look at all the big blockbusters in the last 10 years, it seems, in terms of box office, they tend to have that one thing in common. They're number 2, 3, 4, or 5 in a series of films. Is there a general concern in the industry that of the lack of originality, or is this just overblown and oversimplified?
I say respect, I think somewhat overblown. I mean, this fall, again, you're going to see, the other day, the film critic for the Los Angeles Times, I don't know how many, one of my favorite TV shows is the CBS Sunday Morning show, which I love. And there was a piece,
now you're showing your age.
I know.
I'm just saying.
It's a nice way to wake up on Sunday morning. But he did a piece on the product coming out this fall and was raving about what's going to be available to audiences. I mentioned Lincoln already, The Master, Les Miserables, Life of Pi, which is going to be, I think, very exciting as an animated film. They're going to be a number. So there's going to be some great product out
good
there
point,
for people.
Yeah.
And these are not all the blockbuster types that you talk mm-hmm. about. So there is that. And I think, again, we make in this country, I think, around 750 films a year. That obviously goes beyond the six major film studios that make, on average, I think, around 20. Mitch, you correct me, around 20 a piece a year. So you're getting an awful lot made outside of the major film companies. And that are a terrific product. And sometimes they don't get the publicity that others do. So I think it's unfair in a way. I mean, that you get this, some of it's formulaic. Things work, and they go back. And again, it is a business. I mean, and so you're going to have to. I think it's remarkable within this business that in fact there are so many courageous people making films that don't necessarily, and they know it, are not going to produce great box office results, but are making significant contributions to the art form. It's an accessible, democratic art form. Globally available to people. I mean, you think of it, I took my two daughters to a Nationals game in Washington the other day. It's been a long time since I brought anybody to a baseball game. I mean, and we weren't sitting on the first base or third base line. It's expensive. You go to a symphony, you go to a Broadway show, you go to an opera. I mean, and understandably so. I'm on the board of a couple of theaters and so forth, and it's an expensive product. You can still go for those two hours or 3 hours in a darkened theater in that communal environment. There's a wonderful story about Sam Goldwyn that I thought was such a revealing point. He thought a comedy, and he went to look at it in the screening room, and he thought it was dreadful. He didn't crack a smile in the thing. But a group of his staff, this is going back to the 1920s, 30s. I said, well, we'd like to see it. And so he screened it for them. And he's walking by the screening room, and he hears gales of laughter coming out. And he finally realized that emotions are contagious. I never thought about it before. And so there's that experience where all of a sudden, go in and the lights go down, and we're with a room full of people we don't know. And there's that incredible contagion about emotion, whether it's humor or sadness or fear or excitement, whatever else it is, that you don't get necessarily alone. It's a remarkable experience. That has attracted audience, and I think will continue to do so, even though people also want that opportunity on their iPhone, on their iPad, on their personal computer, when I want it, how I want it. And if you can't deliver that, you're going to lose. And that's the great beauty of the technology side of all of this equation, which is what we're trying to do, to make that available, without necessarily walking away from what Martin Scorsese says. I paint big screens. That's what I do. And I want to continue doing that. And I think there's an audience for that.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Chris Dodd, Chairman and CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America. I'm Gavin Newsom, your Lieutenant Governor and Moderator. And Senator, just because I'm getting so many questions related to your days in the Senate, your work in the Peace Corps, et cetera, I'll just sum it up. And what was, and this is an actual question, after leaving the Senate, what do you miss the most? And do you have any memorable experiences that are indelible? Or is there one that stands out as the most indelible experience in memory of your Senate days?
I'll tell you just a couple of things. One, it saddens me to watch this remarkable institution, our Congress. Here, your congresswoman in the city is the Speaker of the House, or was the Speaker, now the Democratic leader, and to watch it falling apart in many ways. Now, it's not the first time. It's happened historically, and this is they go through patches of this time. So I don't like seeing this happen because we deserve better. It really bothers me that we are demeaning and belittling people who run for public office. Even people, I get furious with audiences who will get involved in these kind of ad hominem attacks on people I totally disagree with. Mm. I was with an audience not long ago, and I'm a strong supporter of President Obama. So let me just be very clear. But I got furious with an audience who belittled Mitt Romney. Now, I don't agree with Mitt Romney on anything I can think of, but I admire the fact that he's willing to be on that arena floor to engage in the public debate of our country. And we need to celebrate people willing to do this. And I'm very worried that it gets harder and harder. Forget about running for president or the Senate or governor or Congress. Getting people to serve on a board of education or a city council. Do anything like this is getting harder when you think of what we put people through in this gauntlet that you've got to run. And I'm very worried that we're all going to pay a price for that. If we shrink the pool of people who are willing to engage in that public discourse that is the hallmark of our democracy, I think we're in trouble. And I miss the camaraderie. I had great friends, and still do, obviously. And Senator Kennedy was my closest friend in the Senate. We were inseparable for 30 years. His pals, I gave the eulogy when he died. I still get emotional when I think about him. Mm. Being gone, such a remarkable person. And we had such great fun. I was telling his story earlier today. The first week in the Senate, I'm nervous as I can be. I've been in the Senate about 10 days.
One of the youngest ever to come out of your state.
I was young at that point, but this is there's a lunchroom. There's a lunchroom where only senators are allowed to eat in. You can't bring your family. You can't bring your staff. There are two tables. Theoretically, one for Republicans, one for Democrats. No one paid any attention to it. You'd sit where you wanted to sit. I walk in with a tray to eat, and I'm looking down, and there's Bob Dole and Howard Baker and Ted Kennedy and Scoop Jackson and Alan Cranston. I mean, just these giants of the Senate this day, and they're not talking much. They're just kind of eating. And the only seat at the table is at the head of the table. Now I'm holding my tray, and I'm going, I don't think so. That doesn't look really good to me. But no one's saying anything, and no one's getting up, and I'm sitting there. I think, well, I'm looking stupid if I don't sit down, too. That's a problem. So I go to sit down, and everyone at the table goes, you can't sit there. What are you doing? My Lord, don't you know you can't sit in that chair? I said, well, whose chair is this? They said, that's Chairman Jim Eastland, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's his seat. I said, he's been dead for 10 years. They said, we know, but he may come back. And they waited for me to show up. It may sound silly to you, and it is silly. But it was those relationships that were so critically important. They debated, they argued, people at that table, but they also understood each other. They appreciated each other. The day I left the Senate, a new senator came up to me and sort of teasingly said, you're leaving, I'm coming, what's your big advice? And Gavin, when I said to him, I said, well, I'll tell you what the big advice is. You're in the minority for a year. No one's going to pay much attention to you the first year. But if I were you, I'd pick out the 15 or 20 people in this chamber you think are your ideological opposites. Hmm. And I'd take each one of them out to breakfast, lunch, and dinner over the next 6 or 8 months. And you'll discover three things. Hmm. One, you'll like them a lot more than you could imagine. Two, you're going to agree with each other on more than you ever want to admit, probably. Mm-hmm. And as a result of those first two, you'll do things together. And that's what the country expects.
Yeah.
If you come to a legislative body as important as the United States Senate, find out the things you agree on and then go to work on them and make a difference if you can. And we need to promote more of that, in my view. So I miss the place, but it was time. I knew it was time when I looked down the committee I was serving on as chairman, and Mark Warner, the former governor of Virginia, as a new senator from Virginia. He was also my driver in the first campaign I ran for Congress.
Wow.
And sitting next to him was the new senator from Colorado, Michael Bennett, and I defeated his father in the Democratic primary. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time. I ought to move on. So enjoyed the experience. It's nice you asked the question. I appreciate it.
No, and let me just extend, because I'm interested. You know, you brought up that fabulous film that I'm hearing so many great things about, Lincoln. And reminds me of Lincoln's old saw. He said, we're all born originals, but we die copies. And I wonder, from your perspective, going back to being there with that tray, and all that energy and exuberance, and you know, did you feel that you had to sacrifice over the years, not because of your own passions, but because the institutional constraints, that the interest groups were so dominant that your capacity to maintain your originality, your exuberance, your creativity was substantially hindered by the reality of that environment that persists even today?
I didn't. I mean, I always was mystified by people. What are you doing there? If you don't know how to say no to somebody, you don't deserve to be there. I have a problem with people who think that, you know, that the pejorative lobbyists. A good lobbyist can be very valuable in a debate and discussion. A good lobbyist will bring you honest information from the point of view they share, but I always found the ones who were honest and reliable were actually valuable in the debate and discussion. And if I found one that wasn't, I never left them in the office again. It wasn't complicated. You either were a reliable individual or you weren't. You weren't, see you later. You never get in this office again. And I found, by and large, people were pretty good. I mean, they had a point of view. They argued for it. And so, you know, I'm somewhat mystified by this fear that First Amendment right, your right to petition government, is critically important to be able to make your case. And you deal with a lot of different people, and over the years, and nine different political contests over the life, and those years, there are different moments. You know, interest group coming forward and petitioning their government, making their case, is healthy, in my
then
view.
Then what's wrong with Congress today? I mean, it just seems everyone wakes up.
Well,
to
no,
put,
what you got? You got two issues of the problem. One is you've got a House where you only have about 50 seats that are competitive seats, and that is at least competitive between the two parties. The lines have been drawn in a way to guarantee a Republican victory or a Democratic victory. And the only thing you have to worry about if you're a Republican is someone to the right of you is going to knock you off, and if you're a Democrat, someone to the left of you. So you're ending up, the idea we have to listen to other voices.
Do you support then nonpartisan redistricting?
Absolutely. I think what California did was great. I think what Iowa did is great. I think it's the right step in moving in that direction. But only, unfortunately, two states have done it. You're one of them. The second thing is what I talked about. It wasn't that many years ago, the federal government only played for two round-trip tickets for a congressman and senator to go home to their state or district. Mm. Today, you can go home five times a day if you can make a public purpose of your going back. So you now have 75 or 80 House members living in their offices, because what they do is they leave on Thursday nights, they come back Monday night or Tuesday mornings, they spend 2 days, and they get out of town again. So no one knows anybody. And all they know about them is what the political label is on them, rather than what their interests are, what they may care about, what they believe in, what motivates them, all of those things that are absolutely essential in any institution, public or private. You've got to get to know each other. I don't care where you work. That's a critical element of making the operation successful. And when you strip that out, the ability for people to know each other, you end up with the polarizations that have occurred. And so both the redistricting, which is breeding, that's usually the farm system, if you will, for governors and right. senators and presidents and so forth, is unfortunately, I think, really hurt us terribly in that regard.
Hollywood's viewed how on the Hill now? Positively, because you mentioned Republicans understanding the economic opportunities to bring film and production into their states, or is it still the bastion of progressive politics and liberalism?
Well, I think there's that, and that's something I, you know, again, I appreciate the fact that they've been people, they're artists in many ways, they're creative, they press the edge. I mean, putting aside the talk about the sort of the tentpole stuff, there are far many more films every year that press the edge and tell stories that are provocative. And so there's sort of a natural, I think, inclination for people who are in that world to feel that way. Again, I come back to something I said earlier to you, Gavin, and that is, and I say it again respectfully, I don't think the industry has done a good job at telling its story about how it's important. I think people accept that it's important culturally and has made a difference in many ways. I don't think there's much of a knowledge of how important it is economically in the country. And I think we need to do a better job of understanding. We're also, it's not old media. These are incredibly sophisticated technology companies. And we need to go back, and I'm sounding like I'm a broken record on this, but that idea of getting away from this notion that it's a zero-sum game, that it's, you need to choose where are you in this choice matter between right. technology and content. And that I think, again, the basic notion I think most people agree with, that we ought to respect the creative contributions of people, whether it's the creative contribution in producing some remarkable new technology or the creative contribution to producing some great content. These are great, great Americans producing wonderful products, putting people to work and making a difference. And the idea that one is sacrosanct and the other is not defies logic, in my view. And so we need to start building responsible coalitions of people who understand the importance of both. I would do anything and everything I could to protect the Internet and protect the vitality of that. I'm hoping I can also find some people who are as committed to protecting the ability of someone to create and produce something as moving and as important in the entertainment area that is important to us as well. This ought not to be you get to do one, protect one, and not the other. We're talking about the same audience in many ways. One's a user, the other's the audience, same person.
Credits.org, you started to provide yeah. that education. Final question, out of time. You debated President Barack Obama, then Senator Barack Obama.
Right.
Tomorrow night is a presidential debate. Your advice to Governor Mitt Romney.
When is this radio show going on? Well, you know, it's something, Gavin, I think you've appreciated. I certainly did over the years. I mean, I never once stood up in an election and said, let me tell you, folks, this election's about me. That would pretty much guarantee a rather short public life and career, elective office. And too often I think we ask the question, is would I like to sit down and have a beer with this guy or this candidate? And that's really not the right question. That's not what we ask. We voters are selfish. It's not so much whether or not, this guy would sit down and have a beer with us. What we really are asking is not do we get to know him, but does he know us? Do you know us? Do you know me? And that's really the question we're asking. And I think Mitt Romney, and I say this respectfully, has had a hard time convincing people that he's anxious to know us. And that's a big us, whatever us is. And I think if he doesn't do it in the first 45 minutes tomorrow night, it's over with in many ways. And these other battleground states and so forth, the Obama campaign has a very good campaign going, a very good retail operation on the ground. Presidential races, unlike a race for city council, lieutenant governor, Senate, is less issue motivated. I know this surprises people when I say this. It's such a big job that issues are important, but they are less important than these broader questions we ask. What sort of a human being is this? How will he make decisions or she make decisions in a broader way? We insist on far greater issue orientation on a city council race, a Senate race, a governor's race. What are you going to do about the highway? What are you going to do about the education budget? With presidents, we ask the question, but our expectation is different. And so it's much more of an emotional question than a specific one about Medicare, Medicaid, or education. We like the answers to that, but we're also seeking something larger in the answer than specifically what are you going to do in a certain area. And that's, to me, I think the president has to worry that he doesn't come across as I know everything, and Mitt Romney has to come across as someone that is anxious to know who we are as a people. And I think if he does that, this will be a very competitive race in the next 40 days or 35 days. And if he doesn't, I think it's going to be he's going to have a tough road.
Well, our thanks to Chris Dodd, Chairman.
Thank you all very much for joining us.
And thank our audiences here on television, radio, and the Internet. I'm Lieutenant Governor. Now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.